Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Wednesday, May 4th, 2022. Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell announcing an interest rate increase of 0.5%, largest such increase in over 20 years, an effort to bring down inflation. Powell saying inflation is much too high, and the Federal Reserve understands the hardship it's causing to the American people. We'll hear from Powell and talk with Axios' chief economic correspondent. President Joe Biden on the economy, pointing to the first federal budget deficit reduction in 6 years. Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas defending a new disinformation advisory board at his department against Republican critics. We'll hear from him and a Senate Republican and talk about it with a national security reporter at The Hill. Maryland Governor Larry Hogan, Republican and possible presidential candidate, calling for a course correction in his party away from the influence of former President Donald Trump. And Team USA from the last two Olympic Games visit the White House. Long-delayed celebrations due to the COVID-19 pandemic. This from the Wall Street Journal. The Federal Reserve approved a rare half percentage point interest rate increase and announced plans to shrink its $9 trillion asset portfolio starting next month, in a double-barreled effort to reduce inflation that is running at a four-decade high. The moves announced after a two-day policy meeting Wednesday will raise the central bank's benchmark federal funds rate to a target range between 0.75% and 1%. The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell holding a news conference at the Fed headquarters in Washington, D.C. He began with a direct message to the American people.
Before I go into the details of today's meeting, I'd like to take this opportunity to speak directly to the American people. Inflation is much too high, and we understand the hardship it is causing, and we're moving expeditiously to bring it back down. We have both the tools we need and the resolve that it will take to restore price stability on behalf of American families and businesses. The economy and the country have been through a lot over the past 2 years and have proved resilient. It is essential that we bring inflation down if we are to have a sustained period of strong labor market conditions that benefit all. From the standpoint of our congressional mandate to promote maximum employment and price stability, the current picture is plain to see. The labor market is extremely tight and inflation is much too high. Against this backdrop, today the FOMC raised its policy interest rate by a half percentage point, and anticipates that ongoing increases in the target rate for the federal funds rate will be appropriate. In addition, we are beginning the process of significantly reducing the size of our balance sheet.
The Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell, later in his opening statement at his news conference, more on inflation and also the reduction of the balance sheet and what future rate hikes may entail.
The Fed's monetary policy actions are guided by our mandate to promote maximum employment and stable prices for the American people. My colleagues and I are acutely aware that high inflation imposes significant hardship, especially on those least able to meet the higher costs of essentials, like food, housing, and transportation. We are highly attentive to the risks that high inflation poses to both sides of our mandate, and we're strongly committed to restoring price stability. Against the backdrop of the rapidly evolving economic environment, our policy has been adapting, and it will continue to do so. At today's committee meeting, the committee raised the target range for the federal funds rate by a half percentage point and stated that it anticipates that ongoing increases in the target range will be appropriate. We also decided to begin the process of reducing the size of our balance sheet, which will play an important role in firming the stance of monetary policy. We are on a path to move our policy rate expeditiously to more normal levels, assuming that economic and financial conditions evolve in line with expectations. There is a broad sense on the committee that additional 50 basis point increases should be on the table at the next couple of meetings. We'll make our decisions meeting by meeting as we learn from incoming data and the evolving outlook for the economy. And we will continue to communicate our thinking as clearly as possible. Our overarching focus is using our tools to bring inflation back down to our 2% goal.
With more on Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell's news conference, joining us on the phone is Neil Irwin, Chief Economics Correspondent with Axios. Thank you for being with us. A half point interest rate increase, first time in a long time. They're getting serious, apparently.
They are. We have a big inflation problem, and the Federal Reserve is really pulling out all the guns to try and compress demand and address the inflation problem that's causing so much discomfort around the country.
Does the Fed chair and the Fed in general think that what they're doing will have an effect, and how soon?
Not overnight. You know, what their tools do when they raise interest rates, when they reduce the size of their bond portfolio, it reduces the supply of money and credit in the economy. Over time, that means less demand for goods and services, and that lower demand is what brings supply and demand into balance, and that's what causes inflation to come down. It doesn't happen overnight. It's the term of art is long and variable lags, meaning it'll take months for these policy changes to have their full effect. So, you know, there's nothing that's going to make inflation go away overnight. But if their policy works, you know, later this year into 2023, we should see these inflation pressures really start to fade.
The Fed also announcing they're going to reduce their balance sheet. Explain in simple terms, what is that and how does it affect the average person?
So during the pandemic, the Fed used a tool to stimulate the economy called quantitative easing, where they bought billions and billions of dollars worth of treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities. It was a way to essentially pump money into the financial system. And until a couple months ago, they were continuing to do that. This is the reverse of that. This is essentially letting, as these bonds mature and these mortgages get paid off, it's essentially letting those roll off and not replacing them. So in the process, you're essentially putting that process in reverse. You're essentially taking money out of the financial system. And that's one more tool they're using to try to tighten credit, tighten money supply in the economy.
Another problem in the economy has been the supply chain bottlenecks. The Fed chair answering a question about that, saying that they can't do much.
That's right. Their tools are very blunt. They're not finely trained tools that can address supply blockages. And they raised the possibility that, for example, the Russia-Ukraine war and COVID lockdowns in China will actually make these supply problems worse. What they can do, however, is try to control the amount of demand in the economy so that even when there are these supply disruptions, we don't have the kind of broad-based inflation that we're starting to see.
We're talking with Neil Irwin with Axios. The Fed chair, Jerome Powell, opened up his news conference by speaking directly to the American people. Have you ever seen that before?
I mean, he often will have a kind of blunt introduction where he's clearly not just trying to talk to markets and bond traders, but to talk to ordinary Americans. I thought it was very striking. And I think what it tells us is that Jay Powell, the Fed chair, he really is taking this inflation problem on his own shoulders. He's not trying to say, this is somebody else's fault, this is Biden's fault, this is Congress's fault. He's saying, we are the Federal Reserve. Our job is to ensure price stability. We've been failing at that job lately, and we are determined to bring inflation down.
Also, today's news conference in person, first time in a while. That's got to be a good sign.
Yeah, it felt like the first day of school. It was actually a newly renovated building, a new room, and all the Fed press corps was there for the first time in person since before the pandemic.
You were at this news conference. Did any other question strike you as making news with his answer?
There's been a real strong surge on the stock market today. There was some openness and some discussion that maybe they would raise interest rates 0.75 percentage point at a time. And Jay Powell, the chairman, he took that off the table. He said, that's not what we're thinking. That has led markets to say, okay, maybe we don't have to worry so much about some really, really rapid monetary tightening. So that's driven the stock market up a lot on Wednesday afternoon.
Neil Irwin, Chief Economic Correspondent with Axios. Find a story at axios.com and on Twitter at Neil_Irwin. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
And the Dow up today, 932 points. S&P up 124, NASDAQ up 401. Some Senate Republicans talking about the economy at a news conference today and putting most of the blame for high inflation on the policies of President Joe Biden. You'll hear answers from Senator Pat Toomey, Republican from Pennsylvania, and Senator Dan Sullivan, Republican from Alaska.
Yeah. You laid out all the ways you blame Democrats and President Biden for driving inflation up, but Congress gives the Federal Reserve the mandate to stabilize prices. What, if any, blame do you put on the Fed for not acting sooner?
Well, I'll speak for myself. I have been a persistent critic of the Fed. I think they took way too long to acknowledge the problem with inflation, to change course. But as Randy Quarles, a former Fed governor, recently pointed out, President Biden contributed to this problem also. He delayed the decision as to who would be the next chairman way past any previous president making this decision in terms of the governor's cycle, and kind of had the effect of probably freezing the Fed board to some degree that was completely unnecessary. But by far the biggest factor is just the massive overspending. I don't know of a case where a government can engage in the kind of wild, excessive, unnecessary spending and not have inflation emerge as a problem.
Can I say something?
Yeah, I'm going to jump in on this, too. Sure. Sorry. Just the Fed dual mandate, as you know from Congress, is price stability and unemployment rate. That's their mandate. It's one of the most powerful institutions in the whole world. That's their mandate. That's their job. One of the other elements that the Federal Reserve has now been taking up as a mandate is climate change. And in my view, it's a backdoor way to choke off capital to the energy sector. So the Fed, by taking this on, you saw one of these nominees from the president who's seemed like her primary focus was going to be on choking off capital to the energy sector, not price stability or unemployment. She, fortunately, in my view, was not confirmed by the U.S. Senate. But when the Fed and its Republican and Democrat nominees are now taking on this broader mandate, A, it's not their statutory mandate, but B, it goes to this energy issue that we're all talking about. It goes to the same problem. Other agencies who don't have a mandate, Comptroller of the Currency is another example, who all of a sudden think their mandate is to choke off capital to the American energy sector. It's not their mandate. And the Federal Reserve, that's part of their problem. And I think it's also contributing to inflation as it relates to energy prices.
Senator Dan Sullivan, Republican from Alaska, which produces a lot of energy, and Senator Pat Toomey, Republican from Pennsylvania, and he is the ranking member on the Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee, a news conference on Capitol Hill with several other Senate Republicans talking about the economy. From CBS News, President Biden highlighted deficit reduction in remarks Wednesday at the White House, noting that the government will pay down the national debt this quarter for the first time in 6 years. Mr. Biden emphasized how strong job gains have increased total incomes and led to additional tax revenues that have improved the government's balance sheet. Here's the president.
This week, my administration released new information that contains that we're on track to cut the federal deficit by another $1.5 trillion by the end of this fiscal year, the biggest decline in a single year ever in American history. The biggest decline on top of us having a $350 billion drop in the deficit last year, my first year as president. We also learned that for the first time since 2016, the Treasury Department is planning to pay down the national debt issued to the public this quarter. And for all the talk the Republicans make about deficits, it didn't happen a single quarter under my predecessor, not once. The bottom line is the deficit went up every year under my predecessor before the pandemic and during the pandemic. And it's gone down both years since I've been here, period. They're the facts. And why is it important? Because bringing down the deficit is one way to ease inflationary pressures in an economy where a consequence of a war and gas prices and oil and food and it all, it's a different world right this moment because of Ukraine and Russia. We reduced federal borrowing, and we helped combat inflation. This process is a great deal, is good news, but it didn't happen by itself. The previous administration increased the deficit every year it was in office, in part because of its reckless $2 trillion tax cut. I know you're tired of hearing me saying but a $2 trillion tax cut that was not paid for. And a tax cut that largely benefited the biggest corporations, 55 of which earned $40 billion in profits and paid not a single penny in income tax in 2020. And wealthiest Americans, like the billionaires, who on average pay just 8% in federal taxes. The previous administration not only ballooned the deficit, it undermined the watchdogs, the inspector generals, whose job it was to keep the pandemic relief funds from being wasted. Remember, at the time, I kept saying, they're going to fire the inspector generals. Well, they fired the inspector general. And in my administration, those watchdogs are back.
President Biden at the White House. CNBC has an article about the Treasury Department, and it writes, well, the department estimates that this year's budget deficit will decline by $1.5 trillion. The reason for the smaller deficit is a matter of debate. The article goes on, under former President Donald Trump, the U.S. poured trillions into the economy to lessen the impact of COVID-19 lockdowns at the height of the pandemic and to develop and manufacture vaccines, masks, and other gear needed to protect healthcare workers and others from the virus. As those pandemic-era programs end, the federal government will spend less. And also, the president, President Biden's more modest budget proposal doesn't include a majority of the cost of Biden's massive Build Back Better agenda, a transportation technology infrastructure program the Democrats haven't been able to pass. You can find more at CNBC.com. And now to Russia's war in Ukraine. President Biden saying today that he'll be speaking with other leaders from the Group of Seven advanced economies this week about possible additional sanctions against Russia. And the European Union today proposing a complete ban on Russian oil by the end of the year. It would need to be passed by the EU's 27 member states to take effect. And this from Associated Press, Dateline Lviv, Ukraine, complaining that the West is stuffing Ukraine with weapons. Russia bombarded railroad stations, other supply lines, targets across the country. Heavy fighting also raged at the steel mill in Mariupol that represented the last stronghold of Ukrainian resistance in the ruined southern port city, according to the mayor. But a Russian official denied Moscow's troops were storming the plant, as Ukrainian commanders claimed a day earlier. Latest on the U.S. response to the war in Ukraine from the Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby at today's briefing.
As you're aware, Russia has been hitting a lot more targets out in the west towards Lviv and hitting electrical stations and things like that. Is there a concern that Russia is getting more precise and in their ability to hit critical infrastructure like that? And does this raise concerns about the safety, particularly of diplomats, et cetera, in Lviv? And will the U.S. Defense Department provide additional security for them there?
Can we go out there? You're right. They are attempting to hit what we assess to be critical infrastructure targets out towards the west. Electrical power, transportation hubs, that kind of thing. We think this is an effort to try to disrupt the Ukrainians' ability to replenish and reinforce themselves. We are, you know, particularly these most recent strikes, we're still assessing the degree to which they hit what they were targeted. I would just offer, without trying to correlate specifically to these most recent strikes, I would just remind that their ability to target with precision has been less than advertised throughout this entire war. They are not good at precision strikes. They are not discriminate with how they target. So, again, I'm not making a statement about these most recent ones, but I think it's just good to remind ourselves of their lack of accuracy over the course of the last almost 70 days here. As for security of our diplomats, I'll let the State Department speak to their movements and their security protocols. As I've said before, we're in constant discussion with our State Department colleagues, and obviously, you know, it's typical for embassies around the world to have a U.S. Marine security footprint there. We're not back at the embassy in Kyiv, and so I just don't have anything to specifically to speak to with respect to U.S. military support right now.
As a follow-up, do you see much impediment to U.S. weapons transfers into Ukraine, and are shipments still getting to them successfully, considering these hitting the railheads and all of that?
Yeah, what I can tell you is that the flow into the region continues at an incredible pace, and the flow of materials from the region into Ukraine also continues every single day. And we know that because we talk to the Ukrainians every single day, we know that that material, those weapons, those systems are getting into Ukrainian hands.
Pentagon Press Secretary John Kirby taking reporters' questions in the Pentagon briefing room. A spokesman for the Kremlin, Dmitry Peskov, today dismissing as nonsense speculation that Russia would use its May 9th Victory Day holiday to officially declare war on Ukraine. Victory Day marks the Soviet Union's defeat of Nazi Germany during World War II, 1945. Russia continues to use the phrase special military operation to describe its invasion of Ukraine. Washington Today continues in a minute. And welcome back to Washington Today for Wednesday, May 4th, 2022. Bloomberg government reporting Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas is trying, so far in vain, to assuage Republican concerns that his department's new Disinformation Governance Board will respect civil liberties. The article goes on, the board was created to combat disinformation spread by foreign actors such as Russia, China, transnational criminal organizations, and human smugglers, the department has said. Republican lawmakers have called it an attack on free speech, Orwellian and un-American. Secretary Mayorkas is testifying today before Senate Appropriations Subcommittee and getting these questions from Senator John Kennedy, Republican from Louisiana.
Will the DGB be given its own police, its own enforcement powers?
Senator, as I have articulated, the working group does not have operational authority or capability. Its purpose is to make sure that the work that is underway in protecting the homeland that has been executed for nearly 10 years is done within guardrails according to policies and standards that ensure that that work does not infringe on people's fundamental First Amendment rights, right of privacy, civil rights, and civil liberties.
Right. Yeah, the government's going to tell us what's true. What could possibly go wrong? Can I ask one last question?
Of course, that is quite incorrect.
Is the DGB going to accept referrals from the public where people can call in and say, I think Senator so-and-so said something untrue, and I want you to subpoena him?
Senator, it is so very important that I correct a misstatement that you made that the Department of Homeland Security is going to be the truth police. That is the farthest thing from the truth. We protect the security of the homeland. And once again, allow me to articulate what I have said previously, which is that the working group does not have operational capability and authority. It is to make sure that there are policies in place, standards in place, to protect the very rights about which you inquire.
Mr. Chairman, this will be my last comment. Mr. Secretary, I meant what I said. It is nice to see you, and I do think you're a nice man. But I would call in as soon as you get back to the office, and I would ask that person who recommended Ms. Jankowicz to you, and I would fire him on the spot.
Senator John Kennedy, Republican from Louisiana, questioning the Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas. More on the Homeland Security Department's Disinformation Oversight Advisory Board. Joining us now is Rebecca Beich, national security reporter with The Hill. Thank you for being on Washington Today. What exactly is this advisory board? What is it going to do? And is it what Republican critics say it is?
So I think that's one of those things that people are having a lot of trouble sorting out. So in the big picture, we know it's designed to coordinate best practices among different DHS agencies that battle disinformation on topics that are as varied as migration to natural disasters to plots that could involve U.S. infrastructure. And the board is also supposed to ensure that civil rights and free speech are protected in that process. But both Republicans and, you know, First Amendment advocates and even disinformation experts have complained that DHS just hasn't kind of laid out in detail enough of what the board's mission and scope will be for them to feel comfortable with what it does.
Well, the Homeland Security Secretary has been defending this board now for a good week and a half. He told Fox News Sunday this past weekend the administration could have done a better job in communicating what it does. What has been the rollout of what the board is?
Yeah, so the rollout has been confusing even for those of us that covered DHS. I think it initially was an item in Politico's playbook. And then the AP picked up an article from there. But in terms of a formal rollout, there really hasn't been one. And so, you know, we saw DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas kind of go on the defensive on several Sunday morning talk shows, kind of trying to explain what it does, including what you just referenced, that they could have rolled it out better. He identified the role of the board, you know, not in being an entity to police free speech online, but to look for speech where there's a connectivity to violence and a call for action.
Who is the leader of this board? She also has been under some scrutiny.
Yeah, so her name is Nina Jankowicz, and she is a disinformation expert. She was previously working as a fellow at the Wilson Center. She has a lot of experience in Eastern Europe, but she has a big Twitter following, and so we've definitely seen Republicans both kind of pick apart some of her tweets, but just, you know, other aspects of her social media presence, which, you know, there's been one video that's circulating of just like a song she made to sort of explain disinformation.
As we're talking about this Homeland Security Department effort, I can't help but think of another memo from the Justice Department recently concerning school boards that got Republicans so upset.
In both cases, you see, whether it's, you know, the memo at the DOJ or whether it's this board at DHS, you just see this kind of consistent concern from Republicans, whether it's in a school space, whether it's kind of more in the online space, that, you know, there's sort of this policing of free speech, whether it's something that parents want for their kids or, you know, something that they might say online.
We're talking with Rebecca Beitsch from The Hill. Has this oversight board in the Homeland Security Department put out any paperwork, issued any rulings, done anything public yet?
So they really haven't. And I mean, the other thing to keep in mind is that this was literally announced a week ago. It was announced last Wednesday. The only thing that we do have, aside from Secretary Mayorkas speaking engagements, are they put out a fact sheet to sort of explain what it does. And so one of the interesting lines in this fact sheet is that it just straight up says there has been confusion about the working group, its role, and its activities. This reaction to the working group has prompted DHS to assess what steps we should take to build the trust needed for the department to be effective in this space. And so after that, they make a commitment to, you know, having transparency with Congress, putting out quarterly reports about its activities, and also kind of giving this board a little bit of its own oversight through the bipartisan Homeland Security Advisory Council. So you've sort of seen some edging into, you know, an acknowledgement, you know, from Mayorkas, this could be rolled out better, an acknowledgement in the fact sheet that they're, you know, need to build some public trust in dealing with this. But we still haven't had, you know, a super formal rollout of, you know, the board and its full scope of its mission or activities.
Rebecca Beitsch is a national security reporter with The Hill. Find her story at thehill.com and follow her on Twitter at Rebecca Beitsch, B-E-I-T-S-C-H. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
From the Plain Dealer newspaper in Cleveland, a late-breaking endorsement from Republican ex-President Donald Trump was enough to boost Senate hopeful J.D. Vance to victory in Tuesday night's Ohio Republican primary for retiring GOP Senator Rob Portman's seat. Vance, an author and former Trump critic, now will face Congressman Tim Ryan, who won the Democratic primary in the general election in November. That from the Plain Dealer. J.D. Vance won 32% in the Republican primary, ahead of Josh Mandel's 24% and Matt Dolan's 23%. Vance at his victory party thanking former President Trump.
I have absolutely got to thank the 45th, the President of the United States, Donald J. Trump. Ladies and gentlemen, one forgiveness example of what could be in this country, ladies and gentlemen. Remember 2019 when wages were going up and not down? Remember 2019 when workers were doing well in this country, not struggling terribly? Thanks to the president for everything, for endorsing me. And I got to say, a lot of the fake news media out there, and there are some good ones in the back there. There's some bad ones too, let's be honest. But they wanted to write a story that this campaign would be the death of Donald Trump's America First agenda. Ladies and gentlemen, it ain't the death of the America First agenda.
J.D. Vance Tuesday night victory party in the Republican primary for that open U.S. Senate seat from Ohio. The winner on the Democratic side, as mentioned, Tim Ryan. He won nearly 70% in his primary election, he also spoke to supporters.
Right now, we're coming out of the pandemic. We're coming out of the great economic collapse. There's a war. The issues of freedom are all across the globe. Here at home, just today, we saw an issue of freedom, right? Average people working their rear ends off, trying to make ends meet, fighting, biting, scratching, pinching, clawing, right? It's about economic freedom for them. Climbing to the top, enough money to have a vacation, enough money to pay the bills, enough money. That's economic freedom. That's what this campaign is about. And I tell people, look, I'm not here to get in a fight. I'm not going to win on election day and try to punish 50% of the people that are living in this state or in this country. We are here to heal. We are here to become Americans. We are here to come together. And I want Ohio to be the economic powerhouse of not just the United States, but of the world. I want us to be the builders again.
Tim Ryan, Tuesday night, Democratic candidate and now nominee for U.S. Senate seat in Ohio, will face off against Republican J.D. Vance in the general election in November. Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine winning his party's nomination for a second term in office on Tuesday, and he will face the winner on the Democratic side, Nan Whaley, former mayor of Dayton. From the Associated Press, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan is urging Republican voters to stand up against the extremes, saying the GOP is desperately in need of a course correction as the term-limited governor weighs a presidential run. Governor also criticized former President Donald Trump's denial of his loss in the 2020 campaign, saying the divide in the Republican Party is more of a difference between those who know how to win and those who only pretend that they won. That was from AP. Here's Governor Hogan Tuesday night at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Foundation and Institute in Simi Valley, California.
The problems that have caused our party to repeatedly lose have not been addressed. It's easy to make excuses for the failures on our side by pointing out that the other side is often worse. But better than the Democrats isn't good enough. That isn't a winning strategy or a long-term roadmap to success. Americans are completely disgusted with the toxic politics. And they're sick and tired of all the lies and excuses. Excuses, lies, and toxic politics will not win elections or restore America. Only real leadership will do that. We won't win back the White House by nominating Donald Trump or a cheap impersonation of him. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. And we don't need just another typical professional politician who bends with every political wind and stands for nothing. We do it by nominating a candidate who speaks to the majority of Americans who are completely fed up and ready for a change. Ladies and gentlemen, I can tell you this. I am not about to give up on our party or on America. None of us can. Because this is not just about the differences between the right and the left. This is about the difference between right and wrong. And this isn't just the typical fight between Democrats and Republicans. It's more important than that. This is a fight for America's future. And that is a fight worth fighting for.
Governor Larry Hogan, Republican from Maryland at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in Simi Valley, California, part of a speaking series there named Time for Choosing, and it often attracts possible presidential contenders. Governor Hogan is the only Republican governor ever reelected in Maryland's history. Democrats there currently outnumber Republicans 2-1. He is term limited and can't run again. From the Des Moines Register, the Iowa Democratic Party is promising to rework its caucuses as party leaders begin a formal application process that will determine whether it can continue holding an early presidential nominating contest. For the last 50 years, Iowa has kicked off that process with its first in the nation caucuses. DNC has long blessed the ritual, granting waivers to Iowa and three other states, New Hampshire, Nevada, South Carolina, allowing them to hold their caucuses and primaries before the rest of the country. But the DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee voted in April to open up the process, allowing any state that wants to hold an early contest to seek a new waiver. That reporting from the Des Moines Register. The Iowa Democratic Party Chair, Ross Wilburn, led a virtual news conference today.
This morning, the Iowa Democratic Party submitted our letter of intent to the DNC's Rules and Bylaws Committee to begin the formal application process in our fight to keep Iowa first in the nation. A copy of the letter will be emailed to all of the journalists on the call as soon as our press availability is finished. Let me be very clear. The letter of intent is just the first step in a robust application process. In addition to our application, we're also planning to engage with numerous stakeholders all over Iowa to explore substantive changes to the caucuses that would make them more straightforward and accessible. It's important to us to continue to evolve Iowa's caucuses so that as many people as possible can participate in this proud tradition. Iowa has a critical role to play in our presidential nominating calendar. We're a small state and we provide the perfect opportunity for Democrats to rebuild their national brand within rural communities. That's why it's critical that Iowa continues to have a voice in the presidential nominating process so that candidates can meaningfully connect with a grassroots infrastructure that includes working families and a diversifying rural America. We've got a lot of work to do ahead of us in the next few weeks, but I'm going to fight like hell for Iowa, and I'm going to look forward to making our case before the Rules and Bylaws Committee.
Ross Wilburn chairs the Iowa Democratic Party, a virtual news conference today. And the DNC has asked each state that wishes to go near the beginning in the 2024 presidential election, primary, and caucus season to send first a letter of intent, then a full written application, and then the Bylaws Committee plans to whittle down that list and select the states it wants to have in to hold in-person presentations. That's expected in June. NBC News has this. Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski said Wednesday she would look at the legislation Democrats are expected to bring to the floor next week that would codify Roe v. Wade, but noted that when the Senate voted to proceed to the bill earlier this year, she opposed it. She said, "I would actually like to see what changes, if any, had been made to that. As you know, I did not support it last time because I felt it was overexpansive and did not take into account some of the assurances that I think most want to ensure are kept in place as they relate, for instance, to religious freedom issues." In February, the Senate voted 46-48 to block a bill pushed by Democrats to codify abortion rights into federal law. And again, a vote is expected on that as well next week. This all comes after the Supreme Court draft majority opinion overturning landmark decision Roe v. Wade, making abortion a constitutional right, was leaked to the press this week. Today, the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki asked about any preparations if that draft turns out to be close to a final decision in the case.
If the Supreme Court does move to strike down Roe, should Americans be prepared to accept that decision as legitimate, and would President Biden accept that decision as legitimate?
Well, I can't speak for what actions could be possible on the legal front. I would point you to the Department of Justice on that. But what I can tell you will happen is, and this is what we are preparing for the possibility of, that if Roe were to fall, abortion would probably be illegal in about half the states in the country, up to 26 states, particularly in the South, the Midwest, and West, who have all spoken out, many leaders, about how they're poised to restrict or ban access. Some have even taken action, even as recently as yesterday, as crazy as that sounds. And depending on the court's decision, 13 states even have trigger laws. Trigger laws mean they would basically immediately put in place bans. And as a result of all of this, tens of millions of women may lack access to reproductive health care services as soon as this summer, if that were a decision to be made. I'd also note, and as we're thinking about and working with not just the Gender Policy Council, but also the Department of Health and Human Services, also members on the Hill, also the Council's office, what we're really focused on is the impact this would have. It would dramatically reduce access to reproductive care, particularly for women With low incomes, women of color, women in rural communities. We know that 75% of those seeking abortions are living at or below 200% of the poverty level. And the majority of patients seeking abortions identify as Black, Hispanic, and AAPI. So if you look at the 26 states, let's take for example, or the 13 to 26 depending, and you look at a map, that means that women, the majority of whom are below that poverty level and are Black, Hispanic, or AAPI, are going to be forced to figure out how to travel, how to take time off of work, how to get childcare. It is a prohibitive cost. It will not be safe, and that is what we are focused on working to address as we're making policy decisions and considerations.
It sounds like you're saying then that's a yes, he would consider this a legitimate decision.
Well, there is not even a decision yet. We don't know the validity of the, we know that this is a leaked document. It is not the final opinion, so I just can't speak to that hypothetically at this point in time.
White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki taking reporters' questions in the White House briefing room. The Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell spent Tuesday deflecting some questions about the possibility of Roe v. Wade being overturned and what that meant from a policy perspective. Instead, McConnell focusing on the fact of the leak that a private draft Supreme Court document was disclosed. Today on the Senate floor, Senator Mike Lee, Republican from Utah, spoke to the issue.
Mr. President, Justice Alito's draft opinion in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health is a masterpiece of jurisprudence, and it's a long overdue victory for the preborn. It's also a vindication of nearly 50 years of tireless efforts by the pro-life movement, the conservative legal movement, by textualists and originalists, and by President Trump's recent judicial appointments.
Senator Mike Lee on the Senate floor. The draft majority Supreme Court opinion that was disclosed this week was dated in February. The case itself, the oral argument, took place in December, and a final decision issued publicly and formally could happen near the end of the current term, June, or even into July. On the White House lawns, about 600 members of the U.S. Olympic and Paralympic teams from the Tokyo and Beijing Games, Team USA, gathering. A double get-together making up for all the delays and cancellations caused by the COVID-19 pandemic. First Lady Jill Biden among the speakers.
Becoming an Olympian or a Paralympian is a rare accomplishment in a normal time. But you did it during a global pandemic. You are forever one of the most elite, most celebrated athletes in this world. I hope that you are proud of everything you have accomplished, because we all are. We are so proud of you. And we are grateful for the gifts you've given us, the hope, the joy, the unity, and most of all, the chance to see all of you soar. Thank you.
First Lady Jill Biden addressing the athletes on the White House at South Lawn. She made her first solo overseas trip last summer to Japan to attend the Summer Olympics, officially the 2020 Olympics, but delayed until 2021 because of the coronavirus pandemic. And the athletes on the lawn also from the just completed 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. The Bidens did host a virtual celebration for Team USA from the Tokyo Olympics from their home in Delaware last year. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Get more Washington stories sent to your inbox each day by subscribing to C-SPAN's evening newsletter Word for Word. You can sign up at c-span.org/connect. Have a good night.